of probable cause in this case was premised on an informant's statement and on the document, both of which failed for similar reasons. The conclusory assertion that the informant was reliable and that the dogs had been trained were insufficient to justify a finding of probable cause. It's incumbent on the government to establish that the source of the information that constitutes probable cause are reliable, because that's not the case we're asking for a remand.
Well, if the information is corroborated by what the police find when they follow up, isn't that good enough?
Your Honor, it's true that corroboration can bolster an informant's tip, but there were several problems with the corroboration in this case. For one, the corroboration was limited to innocent facts, the fact that a car was parked in a particular lot on a particular license plate, that the car had been broken into. Those facts in particular are ones that would have been visible to anybody who was driving by.
Let me ask you, I guess I don't see where there is the problem with this informant. Granted, it's an informant who's got some baggage from the past, but what is it about this informant that you think is so tainted? I guess I don't follow.
Sure. To start off with, the problem with the informant is that, although under Illinois, you look at the
totality, right? Mm-hmm.
That still takes into consideration the basis of knowledge and the informant's reliability. In this case, the basis of knowledge was the statement that he knew of a particular transaction. There's nothing from that. The language suggests distance. It doesn't say anything that assures the court that this was not simply a rumor that was circulating in the underworld. As far as reliability, there was simply a conclusory statement that the informant was reliable. There was nothing, and that was on cross-examination, in fact, that he had proved reliable. There was nothing regarding the informant's track records. There was nothing suggesting that he had given information which had concretely proved true and that had led to a search warrant, to an arrest, to an indictment, something like that.
Is that necessary? For reliability, you have to have a... what's the criteria of this track record you think is necessary?
I think both the Spinelli case and the Miller case, both of which we cite in our brief, say that simply telling the magistrate, in the Miller is a warrant case, but in the context of a warrant, simply saying that the informant was reliable is not sufficient without additional evidence regarding the informant's track record and concrete that is information that doesn't constitute. And that's in Spinelli.
But that's if it's a warrant case, that's what you're telling the reviewing magistrate judge, what that individual judicial officer knows in terms of whether or not to issue the warrant. Here it's a warrantless situation. So we have to look post hoc at the record of this particular informant.
That's true, but of the two cases, Spinelli and Miller, both of which are cited along with, I believe, the Seventh Circuit case in our brief, one of them was a warrant, one of them was an informant tip. I don't remember which was which, but either way, the criteria would be the same, that there must be something more than a conclusive statement that the informant is reliable. And that's my central problem with the informant in the case. The problem with the corroboration is, again, with an innocent facts which would be visible to anybody who was driving by. They didn't consider some of the very basic facts.
Well, am I correct? You make it sound as if they arrested him just on the basis of the tip. And if I understand it, there was a lot of police work that went on in between.
There was corroboration of the tip. There was the district court pointed to three things. The informant's tip. Second was the dog sniff, which was saying that because there was no evidence or indication that the dog was reliable, that should be a nullity, that should not count in the probable cause analysis. And the third was that he had not responded to calls.
Right. He took it for repairs, and then he didn't respond to their calls to pick it up.
And I think that's an equivocal fact here, because, it could mean that he knew that the police were on to him and that he was hiding out and deliberately not going to get the car.
But and he had told the hotel people the day before that they should keep an eye on the car, all that stuff. Yeah.
To the car.
Right.
But the other thing, what was clear here is that Mr. Waldron had, in fact, been calling the dealership, that there were phone records. records establishing that he raised multiple calls on the 5th, multiple calls on the 6th, multiple calls on the 7th. The dealership was closed. There were no calls on the 8th, and the dealership was closed on the 9th. But because of that, I think it is an equivocal fact. It could mean that he knew.
Yeah, they left it there. It was equivocal. Okay, so they left it there. He left it there, and then they ran the dog sniff.
And there, that's, what we're saying is that because there's only evidence that the dog was trained, training is actually a poor proxy for the liability.
But you didn't, as I understand it, in the district court, there was no issue with respect to the dog. It wasn't even brought up that you had a problem with the dog sniff part of it.
That's true, and the government has claimed that the dog sniff is waived. But this court's precedent in the Arnold case and in Polaris Milan state that while claims can be waived, arguments are not. Here clearly the claim that probable cause did not exist was preserved, and based on the Beal case that you cited, once the probable cause is an issue, or to the extent the government wants a dog sniff constitute probable cause, it has the burden to establish that the dog is reliable. In the Fernandez case, it says that a dog who's alerted to a bag, if there's not that other evidence that the dog is reliable, is worthy of almost nothing.
But if you didn't raise the issue below, what's the context in which this demonstration of the dog reliability is supposed to have been developed? I mean, the government wouldn't be expected simply to come forward with this information when no one is causing any question with respect to the dog.
In fact, I think that is what we would require, that there is some baseline showing, which the government could have made here but didn't, that the dog had been trained a certain amount of time, that there was a particular error rate, that the dog had been on the job.
But the government didn't know you had any question about it. I mean, I don't understand how it's fair to say, well, they should develop an issue that you haven't indicated is an issue you wish to address. It doesn't make any sense.
I still think that's what the Beal case says, which is that if the government wants to use it to get toward its burden of establishing probable cause, just like if it wants to use an informant, it has to establish that informant's reliability.
Counsel, can I ask you a question, Judge Goulder? So here's my question. Assuming that if the dog sniff was standing alone, the government would have more of a hurdle to show track record for reliability, etc. Why isn't it enough that the dog was trained and the dog alerted with a sniff as part of the corroboration of the CI? Given the CI said something, we're not viewing the dog sniff in isolation. We've got the dog sniff as a possible corroboration of the CI, and the CI as a possible corroboration of the dog sniff. Now, why in the total circumstances wouldn't we be able to look at all of them?
What's your strongest authority for that?
I think it's the Beal case,
yeah,
and Fernandez, which,
okay,
are the cases that say that without establishing a record of reliability, a dog sniff is, I have a minute, I'd like to reserve it.
Okay, you may.
May it please the Court. Eric Silver on behalf of the United States. What the defendant does here is precisely what the Supreme Court counseled against doing in our case, which is to divide and conquer the facts that were before the district court, came out in isolation and say this one is without a minimal weight, this one is innocent. The court here had the totality of the circumstances. It had a known informant who faced consequences if he or she provided false information, which this court in Rollin indicated as a significant factor when weighing the reliability of the information that was provided. We have a known motivation for this confidential source providing information, which again in Rollin this court indicated is one of the advantages of knowing who the confidential source is. Here we know that the reason the information was provided was for a hope of leniency or monetary gain. As this court indicated, Tatiana Soriano, that goal can't be achieved if the defendant provides false information, which again supports the reliability of the information. finally, we have the statement, at least as to the veracity of the confidential source, that he had provided reliable information in the past. This isn't a conclusory statement as Finnell, which was just as a confidential, reliable informant. Nor is it like you had in the Seventh Circuit case, the defendant cites, Kirk, in which you just have this person is believed to be reliable. What you have is testimony from Special Agent Smith that he's used this person in the past. He said it's over a roughly 3-month period. Other agencies have used this person, and the person has proved reliable. This is like the showing that was made in Jones, the Supreme Court case, in which it was said that the person had provided correct information on previous occasions, and the Supreme Court credited that. And it's like Draper, in which the informant there had provided information from time to time and had proved reliable, and the court credited that.
Putting aside for a moment your totality argument, I understand that. If we are looking just for a moment at the dog sniff, your counterpart indicated the Beal case and the Fernandez case stands for the proposition that it's your obligation, the government's obligation, to establish the reliability of the dog if you're going to rely upon that as part of your probable cause showing. What's your response to that?
Well, back up for the moment, it is our responsibility if we're going to rely on it alone to establish probable cause, not as part of the probable cause showing. But if we just walked a dog around this dealership and that all the evidence we had was loaded to a car, we would have that burden. But still, Rule 12e puts a burden on the defendant to raise objections in district court. And this issue was pointed out. We relied on the dog sniff, cited Lingenfelter. The district court at Excerpt of Record 140 suggested the dog sniff alone would survive probable cause. In response to this, the defendant didn't raise questions about the reliability of the dog or even said there's no evidence in the record to support that. And so I do think this is a case of waiver. Even if it's not waiver in this circumstance, we're left then with the record that we have, which is the government introduced some evidence of reliability, which is the training of the dog, and it was an active service. It may not be that that's the best evidence we could have had, and it wasn't. We could have provided more evidence than that. But I think what's clear is when we provide some evidence of training, the defendant provides no evidence. The evidence here supports reliability. It's kind of a strong showing, but when the defendant doesn't contest it, it is some showing. I would also point out, which I think is important, is that even if we don't establish enough reliability to rely on the dog as the sole basis of probable cause, this court and other courts' precedents support relying on it in the totality of the circumstances. In Spetch, you had two dogs that were at issue there, one of which was had been fairly accurate in the past, and one had. One had been wrong 4 or 6 times it had been used. The court didn't say in Spetch you couldn't rely on that dog that had been inaccurate 4 times. What the court did say there is you could rely on it to corroborate the other dog. Similarly, in the $67,220 currency case of the defendant cites, there was no evidence that trustworthiness that was cited to the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit, in that context, didn't say, without that evidence, this is entitled to no weight. What it did say is it was probative of weak weight and then considered it in the totality of the circumstances and found probable cause based upon it. Those are not novel propositions. All we're asserting here is in the limited circumstances of this case, we're relying on it for corroboration of what the confidential source said, as opposed to the full showing of probable cause that what was done here was sufficient. I also wanted to go to the corroboration of the confidential source. The corroboration that was done here was detailed. It was specific. It was that there was an African-American male with a black H2 Hummer with North Carolina plates that was located at a specific hotel, the Holiday Inn at LAX. There were specific details that were provided about the break-in. There was that the window was broken, that the steering column was damaged. There was that the security guard had tried to chase away the individual. These are specific facts that the police, the officers tracked down in this case. And it's those specific facts that corroborate what the confidential source said. Again, here to start with, we have a reliable confidential source which tips the scale heavily towards the finding of reliability in general. I also want to
And also, not all of those facts are innocent.
Not innocent. In fact, part of the court's reliance here was that there were suspicious facts in the circumstance. The defendant's response to him being told his car was broken into wasn't to call the police. It was, why don't you watch it? In fact, the record indicates that there was no police report filed in this case. He takes it to the dealership with a sense of urgency of getting the repairs fixed. He has only the steering column fixed, not the window, which suggests get it done as quickly as possible. The police get evidence that he was supposed to have checked out of the room prior to this incident and had to pay money to stay beyond this, which suggests also a sense of urgency. And he tells the dealership, as soon as the repair is done, give me a call and let me know. Then we have the evidence after that, when the police arrive on March 7th, that the defendant's been told his car is ready, the dealership has called him repeatedly, and he hasn't come and picked it up. The court was permissible in that circumstance in viewing those as suspicious circumstances, unlike the innocent facts you have in other cases. And I wanted to say something for a moment about the phone records, as the defendant points out that there were phone records here. First, the question is what information the officers had at the time, not what the evidence would show outside of the record. Here, the court at Exeter Record 142 and 143 credited Detective Roche's statements that the dealership had told them, the defendant had been told, his car was ready and hadn't picked it up. The other thing I would say about the phone records is they actually confirm what was said here, which is there are 16 calls on March 7th up until 11:15 a.m. March 7th is the day the police arrived at the dealership. Then from March 7th on to the morning of March 10th, there are no calls during that time frame, which I think confirms what the dealership said. The defendant is not calling the jury during that time, which at least gives a suspicion that he's on to them. It is at a minimum a suspicious circumstance.
I take it this was it was under surveillance during that period?
The car was under surveillance during that period. And in fact, there had been an incident at the hotel. This is at Excerpt of Record, page 120 and 121, in which the hotel had kicked the FBI special agent off the hotel grounds, saying that they thought her badge was fake and that her subpoena that had been faxed there was fake and that while she was surveilling the car. I think in the context of that information, when there had been a break-in to that car, I think it's reasonable to infer that the hotel manager then told the person that owned the car. So again, in the totality of the circumstances here, the court, the Excerpt of Record 137, said there was ample probable cause.
Okay.
The panel has no further questions.
We don't appear to
be. No questions.
Thank you.
I just have a couple of very brief points. First, I would point out that at Excerpt of Record 35, which is part of the government's briefing below, it admitted that its informant had some motivation to lie. And clearly, even though a person is trying to work off a case, it doesn't give them every motivation to pass along any rumor that they hear.
Most informants do.
Most informants do, that's right. And it does still give them motivation to pass along information that they might hear or that they know of.
Right, that's why we have a little higher standard.
Correct. And as far as the three-month period that the informant had been working, without evidence of what he had done during that period, I don't think the fact that he had been working with them for a period of time is probative of his reliability. Finally, I would just point out
that... But you wouldn't say that we would deem him not reliable simply because a particular case hadn't been brought or in other words, you're not suggesting that there is some objective criteria, a box you have to check that an informant has accomplished a particular case.
Of course not, or else an informant could never get that track record. But what I'm saying is there does have to be something more than just a statement of reliability, which was essentially what we had here. Finally, I would say that Rule 12b, which the government's relying on for their waiver argument, only requires that the motion to suppress be raised before trial. It doesn't require the Polaris Galan and Arnold cases are much closer on point that it's only arguments or only claims that can be waived, not arguments.
All right. Thank you.
The court has another question.
The case just argued is submitted for decision. We'll hear the last case, which is United States versus Lachine.